This is the takeaway for Monday, July 24th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Russia is back at the top of the agenda this week. Today, the president's son-in-law and top advisor, Jared Kushner, appeared in a closed-door session with the Senate Intelligence Committee to answer questions about Russians he met with and meetings he took before the president was inaugurated in January. Kushner says in a statement he did nothing wrong. After his closed-door session with senators, he gave a statement from the White House.
I did not collude with Russia, nor do I know of anyone else in the campaign who did so.
Meanwhile, outside the committee rooms where investigations into scandal continue, over the weekend, Congress agreed to new sanctions against Iran, North Korea, and Russia. The sanctions themselves are relatively straightforward. What's surprising here is how the bill strips many of President Trump's executive powers to remove sanctions unless he asks Congress first. The White House fought hard against this package. Nevertheless, after huge majorities in the House and Senate got set to approve it, the White House said the president would sign. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders on ABC's This Week.
The administration is supportive of being tough on Russia, particularly in putting these sanctions in place. The original piece of legislation was poorly written, but we were able to work with the House and Senate, and the administration is happy with the ability to do that and make those changes that were necessary, and we support where the legislation is now.
The president, meanwhile, appears frustrated. He issued several statements on Twitter. He again called the Russia investigation a witch hunt. Today, he attacked his own attorney general for not investigating Hillary Clinton and Russia, and earlier lashed out at congressional Republicans, saying they're doing very little to protect their president. Stephen Sestanovich is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as U.S. ambassador at large to the former Soviet Union from 1997 until 2001. Stephen, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's a pleasure.
What's the message you think Congress is sending here?
Well, there are a couple of interesting things that are going on. I mean, the basic message that Congress has for the president is you're on the wrong track with Russia. We disagree with you about policy toward Russia, and we want to make it harder for you to pursue the policy that you seem to favor. The president has fought this because he thinks this is prejudicing the investigation of cooperation between his campaign and the Russians. But the opposite is probably the case. He's probably, if he accepts this bill, gaining himself a little breathing room on the question of the investigation by giving up some control over policy.
And also perhaps because agreeing to new sanctions on Russia says, look, I can be tough on Russia. I can approve sanctions. I'm not cooperating with them or being soft.
Every time the president has suggested that he might give the Russians sanctions relief, opposition to him in the Congress has strengthened. And what he has probably belatedly realized is that if he gives ground on the issue of sanctions and on this new bill, he can more credibly say, look, I'm not in bed with the Russians. I'm not duped by Putin. You heard Sarah Sanders say the administration is supportive of being tough on Russia. That is, of course, exactly what people in Congress don't believe. But that's going to be the new line for the administration.
Lawmakers have said they're frustrated with the long term here over the president's reluctance to sanction Russia for the invasion of Crimea, for actions in Syria, for the war in Ukraine, and in particular for his refusal to accept in public that Russia meddled in the elections in the first place. It's a pretty long list that gets behind this frustration that you're talking about.
It is a long list, but it's interesting to note that at the same time, on a lot of policy issues, the relationship with Russia is actually getting worse. It's on this question of whether or not the Russians meddled that the president has kept himself as an outlier.
Stephen Sestanovich, you have a long career in dealing directly with Russians and their diplomats and maybe their spies. I don't know. So there's a piece of news over the weekend that I thought you could really help us with. New revelations in the Washington Post that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who was a senator and also a top campaign advisor to President Trump, not only met with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the campaign, which he originally did not disclose, but that he may have indeed talked about campaign matters with Kislyak, an idea he's flatly denied until now. What do you make of this new information?
What I make of it is it's very stupid to have a wrong and incomplete version of any contacts that you had. It may be that what the Attorney General discussed was, you know, the Russian-American relations. But he was implying that that had no connection with the campaign issue of what Russia policy under a Trump administration would be. Of course, there's a very, very fine line between those two. And the Attorney General looks very foolish now that it seems that he actually had a fuller discussion with Ambassador Kislyak than he claimed.
Information like this, when it comes from intelligence intercepts, as you know, rarely comes out unless there's a reason. Where do you think this information on the Attorney General comes from, and why now?
Well, you're asking the question that everybody in Washington is speculating about, because some people say it may have come from the White House in order to make the Attorney General look bad. Traditionally, people at the White House have said, oh, this is coming from the intelligence community to make the administration look bad. And we don't know the answer to that, but both of them kind of fit the facts as we know them.
But before we let you go, Stephen Sestanovich, on the issue of Russia sanctions and Congress, this does appear to be the first public rebuke, the first sign of real frustration among lawmakers about how the president approaches Russia and handles Russia. Where does this relationship go from here?
Well, there are many other issues that have to be addressed on which the Congress may disagree with the president. There are issues of whether the Russians are violating arms control agreements, what kind of posture they're taking in Syria and toward Iran. There's a lot of potential for disagreement between the Congress and the administration on Russia policy, and it keeps bubbling up.
Stephen Sestanovich is a professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, also a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Well, as Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible collusion between the Russian government and the Trump campaign intensifies, it is possible that members of the president's inner circle could end up facing criminal charges. On Saturday, President Trump responded to that pressure on Twitter, saying all agree the U.S. president has the complete power to pardon. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reported that the president and his staff have begun discussing specifically what the president's power is to pardon members of his own family and even himself. How far, then, does the president's power to pardon actually go? Norm Eisen was the Obama White House's ethics czar from 2009 until 2011. He's currently a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he says no, the president cannot pardon himself. He joins me now. Norm Eisen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Norm, Article 2, Section 2 says the president shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. That's a quote, as you know. If he were in danger of being accused of a crime, why doesn't that power that the president have include himself?
Well, Todd, of course, it doesn't say he can pardon himself. And the notion that he would be able to do that is abhorrent to the whole structure of American law and indeed of the Constitution. The framers would have been shocked to learn that they had to spell that out. The core principle, and it's a uniform one across our justice system, is that no man shall be a judge in his own case. No one can be a judge and the defendant Not even the president. That's why he can't pardon himself.
This has, of course, never been tested. We've never had a president do that. That's part of the reason why you and I are talking about this. But one argument here is that if a sitting president can be indicted, which is another debate that's going on, but can't pardon himself, he would be the only citizen in all of America without the protection of a presidential pardon. And that's not fair.
As the Nixon case teaches us, that's not so. Because the president's successor can pardon him.
Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed.
The president could, in theory, even step down and let the vice president, if he were willing, exercise the pardon power. So there are other expedients besides self-pardon, and it just would be a first, not only in the history of our country, but in human history, to have this kind of a self-pardon. We go all the way back to the monarchies. In an op-ed that I wrote with the Bush ethics czar, Richard Painter, and the distinguished constitutional scholar, Larry Tribe, it is so self-evident that the framers did not feel the need to spell it out in the Constitution.
Well, we're experiencing a lot of firsts, that's for sure, Norm Eisen. What about the idea of preemptive pardons? What's stopping the president from saying, you know what, I'm just going to put a stop to any jeopardy for my family and say, I hereby pardon, let's say, you know, my son Don Jr., my son-in-law Jared Kushner, for any crimes potentially related to the Russia investigation going forward. I'm not accusing them of anything. This is a hypothetical. Could he do that preemptively? What would happen?
Well, it's a little bit like the precedent of George H.W. Bush pardoning Caspar Weinberger before he had been convicted for allegations in the time of that administration. The president could do that. There are a couple limits on him doing that. Of course, the most salient limit is the political one. It would be widely viewed as an abuse of power, just as with Nixon, where Congress, even Republicans in Congress, were pushed and pushed and pushed until Barry Goldwater made the famous trip to the White House to tell Nixon, we no longer have your back. Nixon's resignation followed. That would be politically dangerous, perhaps even politically suicidal. And then there's also the limits of the criminal law. If he did so with corrupt intent, that would not spare him from the president from obstruction investigation. Think of it this way, Todd. It's as if the president does have broad pardon power, but he couldn't accept a bribe
right. To
give pardons.
Right.
Neither can he act with corrupt intent to hide an investigation.
Norm Eisen, ethics czar from the Obama White House on the issue of President Trump and pardons. Norm, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Todd.
In Washington, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is still promising to try and get a vote on some version of repealing the Affordable Care Act this week. But in states across the country, all of the uncertainty around the law, both from Congress and from the Trump administration, is causing havoc. Many states were already having trouble with rising costs under Obamacare. In Colorado, confusion in Washington may be itself driving prices even higher. The state faces high costs due to lack of competition for insurers. For 2018, healthcare providers requested a 27% increase in premiums. There are a lot of reasons for the increases. Colorado has rural areas, but a high cost of living. It has one major urban center, Denver, but lots of sparsely populated rural counties. But Colorado's insurance commissioner says lack of clarity from Washington is making all of the difficulty worse and making healthcare even more expensive. Marguerite Salazar is the insurance commissioner for the state of Colorado, and she joins me now. Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you.
What have you seen in Colorado? You have Denver, the big metro area with lots of kinds of patients, healthy patients, sicker patients, younger, older. That's the kind of thing insurers like, a healthy mix. But what's different in other parts of your state? Why are premiums so high?
Well, you're right that the population center in Colorado really is in Denver, but we've got a pretty big state. And so as we've looked at different areas around the state with the transparency that came with the ACA, people started noticing that their premiums were sometimes double what they were people in Denver were paying. And so as we looked at that closer, we saw that primarily it was the higher cost of healthcare, whether it be from a physician or a hospital. And so we've been looking at those things over the years and talking with providers to see what we could do to drop costs, to try to understand why that's actually happening. But this year really brought a whole new wrinkle when in January we were told that the Affordable Care Act was going to go away. I started talking immediately with carriers, all of the CEOs, bringing them in one at a time, asking them what they thought was going to happen to their companies and whether or not they plan to stay in Colorado. And several actually said that if things change dramatically, they would leave.
So what does uncertainty mean to that type of person, an insurance company CEO, when they come into your office and they say, well, Congress is trying to repeal, they can't get it together, they can't pass a bill, that bill failed. What does that mean to them and how they do business?
There were some key functions within the Affordable Care Act that gave carriers some certainty. For example, the individual mandate. That was key because we needed a really strong risk pool. We needed everybody in the risk pool for this to work. So if that goes away, carriers said, we don't know if we can hang in there. The other thing were the subsidies, the cost-saving reductions, and those were people, you know, referred to them as CSRs, but that goes to help people with their deductibles and co-payments. Those are some of the poorer folks who are, they're not poor enough to have Medicaid, but they actually need some assistance in just paying for their everyday care. So that's another piece that Congress has been saying that they're going to take away. And that was a big piece because the insurance companies realized that without those subsidies, that their members are not going to be able to afford insurance. They're going to drop it. And then we're only going to have the sickest people purchasing insurance. And that's why I've said that's the true death spiral. When only the sickest have insurance, the cost is going to rise even higher.
Commissioner, in fact, it was the Trump administration and the president himself at one point who said they may withhold some of those cost-sharing payments that help defray costs of insurance in an effort to simply make the ACA more difficult in a way to encourage lawmakers to vote for something they wanted. Has that been damaging in Colorado?
Oh, it really has been damaging because what has happened is that they're funding those CSRs month by month. So every month, the carriers are waiting to see if that's actually going to occur. Even though they haven't passed a bill, what we understand is that through the budget process that they can take those away. So yes.
Commissioner Salazar, there was news over the weekend that the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington is using money that Congress pegged for encouraging enrollment into the ACA instead to make videos like this. Listen.
It was very clear to me from reading it that it was going to be a complete disaster. And unfortunately, everything that we predicted, and it wasn't just me, but other people, all of us who read the bill and studied it, everything that we predicted has come to pass, which is really sad.
Commissioner, that's a Denver radiologist called Jill Vecchio who appears in that video produced by HHS, basically attacking the Affordable Care Act from the agency that's supposed to be implementing it. What do you think when you hear a message like that from HHS?
I think that they're not being forthright because what we've seen in Colorado is that we've taken our uninsured rate from 17% to a little over 6%. And in my prior work, I ran a very large community health center. I spent most of my time trying to find ways to pay for people's health care. And so I've seen that the ACA has actually been a rousing success, in my opinion. I've seen people who didn't go into the physician, they didn't get care, finally being able to access care and get the care that they needed so that they could lead a healthy life, so that they could go to school or go to work. And you know, I can't believe that people call it a failure. This finally, people are able to access care. That's all they wanted. And I've said this is healthcare we're talking about. It's not something that they can take out on the street and sell. This is about taking care of themselves and being able to pay what they can afford.
Commissioner Salazar, Colorado, your state, expanded Medicaid under the ACA, of course. How important is Medicaid to the population there?
Medicaid is extremely important because the bulk of the uninsured were right above that line where they didn't qualify for Medicaid. And so now that they do, they've been able, again, to access care. And there's a large percent of people on the expansion of Medicaid that work. There's this misconception that people on Medicaid are just sitting at home with their feet up on the ottoman. That's not true. I think it's something like 70% of the folks on Medicaid expansion actually hold jobs, but they hold jobs that don't offer insurance or just don't allow them to have that extra income to pay.
Let's say the Senate doesn't pass a bill this week. Let's say there's no agreement between now and Labor Day, which seems unlikely. What's your message to Washington? What do you need?
Allow us the time to have some stability, to take the time to, if they're going to make a change, don't do it recklessly. Let's give us at least a year to understand what they want to do and then prepare at the state level to make the changes. My concern is that they want to do something and change it almost overnight. And, you know, these are people's lives we're talking about. We need to not let Colorado go backwards. We're one of the healthiest states in the nation, and we do that because people do have access to care.
Marguerite Salazar is the insurance commissioner for the state of Colorado. Thank you for your time, Commissioner.
Thank you.
A gruesome discovery in San Antonio, Texas over the weekend. At least 10 migrants died after being trapped inside a sweltering semi-trailer that was parked in a Walmart parking lot. Authorities say at least 30 others who were found in the truck were being treated for heat exposure after being inside the trailer with no air conditioning or water as temperatures outside topped 100 degrees. At least two people have died since the initial discovery, and more are still in jeopardy in local hospitals. All of the victims were adult males, and the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Texas says they were victims of ruthless human smugglers, indifferent to the well-being of their fragile cargo. The driver of the truck is now facing federal charges. Denise Brennan is professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at Georgetown University. She writes about migration, trafficking, and labor. Her latest book is Life Interrupted: Trafficking into Forced Labor in the United States. And she joins me now. Professor Brennan, welcome.
Hello.
There are many tragic stories, unfortunately, of immigrants dying in deserts, on perilous hikes across the wilderness, or on trains with bandits or overcrowded conditions. Does this type of situation, these people who perished in a semi-truck in Texas, surprise you?
Well, it's sickening, and it did not have to happen. This is the result of a constellation of policies and decisions to criminalize immigration and to militarize our border. So what you have are people who are fleeing poverty, who are fleeing violence, and many who are reuniting with family members who live here in the United States, who seek to cross in these conditions that force them to pay smugglers exorbitant fees to bring them over borders that otherwise they can't cross.
So what are some of the policies that you think are related to this? I mean, does having border controls in the first place, if people want to come here but can't come here legally, make some hiding and smuggling inevitable?
Yes. So what we have is a militarized border. We have a policy called prevention through deterrence, which is a federal border enforcement policy which encourages migrants to cross inhospitable parts of the desert, which is why you do have so many deaths along the migrant trail. It's also why you have smugglers who are benefiting, who are charging exorbitant prices to help people cross and then pick them up on the other side of the border here in the United States and deliver them to stash houses and points further north. It's likely that this semi was delivering migrants who had crossed on foot to points north up in San Antonio where their loved ones were picking them up. And they could have been bringing them just about anywhere in the United States after that.
Professor, if there is discouragement through deterrence, I'd hate to say it, it sounds like horrific situations like this almost go to the point from the point of view of policymakers, not that they want people to die in trucks, but if conditions are harsh and it's risky, people might not try.
People are going to come to the United States if they have family members here, if they are in danger and fleeing violence, and if they just simply can't put food on the table. I also at times have been baffled as to just the degree of risk that people undertake. You're putting your life in someone else's hands. They promise you safe passage, but everyone knows that that can't be assured. Even an ethical smuggler, an ethical coyote, can take a wrong turn. Somebody can sprain an ankle. You could end up without enough water, and that could be a death sentence.
You're in Arizona now talking to and working with people who've been smuggled into the United States. Tell me what they're saying about their experiences, but what are they saying in reaction to this terrible tragedy in Texas?
I've been spending time with members of this border community who are very involved in keeping their community together, safe from deportation. It is a regular occurrence in border communities and, frankly, throughout migrant communities in the United States outside of what is called the 100-mile border zone for family members to receive people who have just crossed. Frankly, they pray. They hold their breath. They say they don't sleep until their son is in their arms, until their husband gets back to them.
Denise Brennan, it doesn't seem like opening the borders is a feasible answer. The president isn't going to do that. Of course, Congress isn't going to do that. Politically, that's not going to happen in this country. What can be done now in the meantime, given immigration policy, to make tragedies like this less likely?
We need to demilitarize the border so that people who will try to cross are not pushed to go into the most dangerous parts of the desert, and so that they do not end up in the hands of ruthless smugglers like we see this tragedy in San Antonio. We also need to recognize that we have 11 million people in the United States who are here to stay. We need to reckon with the vital economic contributions that they make to our communities and that they are, in fact, a part of our community. We need to create policies that allow people to live healthy, joyful lives. But instead, we've chosen to make the most banal things that people undertake, you know, each day, like driving to work, just a terrifying experience as they worry that they'll get stopped by local police and then turned over to ICE and then a fast track to deportation.
Professor Denise Brennan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Denise Brennan is in the Department of Anthropology at Georgetown University. Her latest book, Life Interrupted: Trafficking into Forced Labor in the United States. Let's go back 27 years now, when two thieves disguised as cops walked right through the doors of Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and walked out with 13 pieces of art worth $500 million. Then this May, all these years later, the museum doubled the reward for the return of those pieces. Give us back the art, they say, and it's worth $10 million to you, but only for a limited time. The offer expires at the end of this year, and Arthur Brandt says he knows where the art is. He's an art detective, often called the Indiana Jones of the art world, and he's convinced that he knows just where these paintings are with the IRA in Ireland. He says this isn't just the biggest theft in art history, it's also one of the biggest mysteries.
We are talking here about the top of the bill, Vermeer, Rembrandt. So it's very strange that since 27 years there has been no real trace of these paintings. And that's the whole mystery. Have they been burned? Are they in the possession of somebody who just doesn't want to talk? But normally when two or three people know about a secret, it's not anymore a secret. And especially when there is a reward like this, you would suppose that somebody would talk.
You know, a lot of people wonder, Arthur, how the economics of art theft really works. Because if you steal a really famous painting of Vermeer or a Rembrandt, this is a famous product. If somebody sees it in your home, they're going to know that is stolen. They've been to the Louvre.
Most often it's being used in the criminal underworld as payment. If there is a drug deal or an art deal and one of the parties do not have the cash, they trade it for a painting. So that is what we see often. And there is another group, and then we are talking about the mafia or the IRA. They use these paintings as a kind of art napping. It's like kidnapping, but with art, with a painting. And they use it when it's convenient for them to trade it with the police or with whomever, if they are in troubles. There was this case in 1974 that an IRA member, Rose Dungal, stole a Vermeer, and she wanted to trade it when the English government would move incarcerated IRA prisoners from England to Belfast so that they could be closer to their families.
So, Arthur Brand, you mentioned the IRA, and it's relevant to this Boston heist because you're convinced these paintings are in Ireland, right?
Exactly. I have spoken to a lot of Irish reporters the last 2 weeks, and they all say, look, since we are investigating the IRA and talking with people within the IRA, they are all convinced that these pieces are on Ireland. There was a strong link between Boston and the IRA. And the IRA has a history of being involved in stolen art. We have been talking for a few years with people within the IRA, and they told us, look, the paintings are in the hands of our leaders. Within the IRA, it's not a secret. Let's call it like that. So summing that all up, I am convinced they are on Ireland.
So Arthur Brand, you're trying to find these paintings. You're the art detective. If you think you know where these paintings are, why are you talking to people like me? Why don't you just keep it quiet and go get these paintings?
Well, the people who have them in their possession, let's say the IRA, did not steal it. The FBI says the two original thieves have died already. So these people who have them right now, what more can the FBI do than say, look, there is $10 million waiting for you? And I, in these interviews that I gave, I said, well, look, I know you can trust the FBI in this case, but if you do not trust the FBI, you can always call me and I will negotiate and we will get these things back.
Let's say this goes the way you think. Let's say the paintings are in Ireland. Let's say the people holding the paintings come to you and they want to do a deal, $10 million. What's your cut?
Nothing. I'm not in this for the money. I earn my money in other things. So this is for me is some kind of adventure. And let's face it, it's the biggest art heist in history. So if I can solve it, I would be very happy because we are also talking about a Vermeer, a Rembrandt, painters from my hometown. So I'm not going to negotiate about a cut for myself.
Well, we wish you all the luck in recovering $500 million of stolen art from Boston. Arthur Brand, art investigator, thank you.
Thank you.
50 years ago this week, in Detroit, simmering tensions between the mostly white police force and the African-American community reached a boiling point. After a police raid on an illegal after-hours bar, violence erupted into an uprising that lasted days. 43 people died in the violence, many more were injured, and thousands of buildings were destroyed. In the days that followed, though, a dedicated and diverse group of people got together and formed a coalition called New Detroit. Their mission was to come to terms with what caused the violence in the first place and to prevent it from happening again. Today, 50 years later, New Detroit is led by Shirley Stancato, who even as a little girl growing up in the city, saw the tension that strained the community.
I do remember sort of a resolve on the part of folks to figure out what happened. There was also very much a, not that there was not a divide to begin with, but the feeling of that there was a greater divide. I lived in a neighborhood where there were blacks and whites, my neighbors were. And clearly not too long after that, that totally changed where many of the whites moved away without having the kind of conversation the neighbors would have to say, you know, I found a new home, I'm moving, or any of the other reasons that people move. A lot of things changed in this community in terms of businesses closing. And really in terms of even in the schools, when I went to the school in the fall, the complexion, if you will, of the schools changed, obviously, because people were moving away.
Now, you head this organization, New Detroit. You mentioned this was formed just days after this uprising, and it's in the name, isn't it? New Detroit. And tell me about that.
It's really a proud moment for our community because we talk often about what happened, this event, if you will, in 1967, but we don't talk enough about the community's response to the event. So at the time, and when I tell the story, I say Republican Governor Romney called up Democratic Mayor Kavanaugh, who was the mayor of Detroit, and said, you know, we didn't see this coming. We need to do something about it. They tapped a 32-year-old Joe Hudson, whose family owned the major retail outlet here, which at that time was Hudson's Department Store, and now is its new iteration is Macy's, and said, ask him to pull together a group of people who could begin to look at what happened, but also not just look at what happened, but what they could do about changing it. And Joe Hudson pulled together a group of 39 people, very unlike any other group, leaders, corporate, business leaders, community leaders, grassroots organization leaders, black and white, to come together to make a decision about what to happen. So that was 3 days after this happened. The leadership in the state said, we need to make a change. And Joe Hudson answered that call at 32. This is our 50th anniversary also. And we continue to meet to work to solve issues. And do we have difference of opinions? Absolutely, we do. But our resolve is to stay at the table, to have the discussions that are necessary, to talk about the elephant in the room and come up with solutions, with ways we can have solutions to the problems that we have. So that was our community's, one of the responses that this community had to this, as people would say, you know, rebellion or uprising or civil disturbance based upon your perspective.
And I want to ask you exactly that. To some people, it's semantics. Which is it? Is it rebellion? Is it uprising? Most people say riot.
People say riot because that's what the media coined it first, and most of the media was white. And I think we spend a lot of time having a discussion about what to call it because it's a safe place for people. I can talk about that and not have to talk about what caused it. And as I often say, people talk about the fire, but not the frustration that led to the fire. At New Detroit, what we say is it's your perspective. To some, it's a riot. I believe it was a rebellion based upon all of the issues that were present in the African-American community at the time that caused this. So it wasn't the police breaking up a party at a Blind Pig. It was all the things that led up to that. It was a complexion of the police department based upon the complexion of the city. And so for some, it's a rebellion. For some, it's a riot. And I think instead of us spending our time naming it, having people understand why I might call it a rebellion and somebody else might call it a riot and someone else might call it a civil disturbance, that's the place where we meet to have the conversation. And through that understanding, figure out ways to make sure that this never happens again.
What else was going on in Detroit at the time when it all touched off?
At the time, there were a lot of issues. So the police department, and you know, you sort of see that today, the police department was only 5% black at a time when the city was more than 40% black. There was a police unit called the Big Four, and I remember this. It was a group of four plainclothes white police officers in an unmarked car who used to drive through the neighborhoods, really, and really, really, really mistreat the young, mostly African-American boys. And I recall, particularly on Saturdays, because that's when we were home, you would hear this yell, the Big Four, and it would be from some kid in the neighborhood. And all the boys would run. And if the police caught you, then they would do what they will with you. And that was one of the pieces of the puzzle, that this whole mistreatment by the police department of the populace that lived there. And then really even leading up to in 67, we had STRESS, Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets, another unit of the police department whose job it was, from the perspective of young kids of color, was to really, really, really treat them as less than human. So the police department was an issue. Housing, affordable housing. Affordable housing was really an important piece for people of color, where there was housing, and many times they were cramped into public housing at the time or places that really weren't big enough for families. Unemployment was really was high at that point, high for people of color. So if you take unemployment, a police department that wasn't reflective or responsive to the citizens that they served, and issues of housing and affordable housing, those are some of the issues, really, that cause this explosion of feelings and explosion of behavior on the part of people in the community. And not just African-American people, because there are whites in the community that also participated in some of the, you want to call it looting, and some of the behavior that really ended up in lots of smoke and lots of fires and lots of destruction of property.
Where is Detroit now? When you take it all in, this city of your youth and city of your entire life, where's the city now?
Well, the city really is moving back in a great way in some ways, and still behind in other ways. Here in Detroit, our conversation now is downtown and midtown is thriving, but then there's the neighborhoods. the focus now is on the neighborhoods. It's great. You have to have a core city that's thriving, and it's wonderful, and jobs are coming back, and new jobs are moving in, and there's all kinds of building and rehabbing everywhere. But the neighborhoods still have a long way to go. And the neighborhoods really are where most of the people of color live. One of the things that Detroit has that in a lot of ways it kind of goes against is we are a large land mass, 139 square miles. You can set Manhattan and San Francisco and Boston inside Detroit and still have land left over. And so when people fled, if you will, then oftentimes they left houses and abandoned them. So the process that we're going through right now is tearing down those houses as a first step. But trust me, a lot needs to happen in the neighborhoods. Really, it's going to take all of us working together to continue to talk about it, but also to continue to focus on what we can do to make change.
Well, it's a 50-year anniversary. It's a time to mark the uprisings of 1967 in Detroit and also the new Detroit that sprung up in the days after. Shirley Stancato is president and CEO of New Detroit and a native and lifelong Detroiter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And finally today, we have some news from all of us here at The Takeaway. On Friday, our host, John Hockenberry, announced that he's stepping down next month. John started this show, and he's led it from the beginning for more than 9 years now. And for all that time, he's brought you the conversations and the debates and the perspectives that could only have come from his journalist's mind. For me, John has been a mentor. He's been an example. And most importantly, he's been a friend. John is leaving us behind, but he's going to keep telling stories in new ways, and we're dedicated to continuing to bring you the kind of journalism he showed us America needs. We're going to miss him, but don't worry, John isn't done quite yet. He'll be back here with you the whole week of August 7th to say farewell, and I'm sure that he's going to have a lot more to say about what he'll be up to in the future. I speak for all of us here at The Takeaway when I say, John, thank you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.